everyone, and welcome to another Fresh Fiction Video Book Club. I'm Samantha T, and today's guest is Susan C. Shea, and we are looking forward to talking about her on all of her different mysteries and the ideas that she comes up and pulling these things together, and of course, all things French that she throws into the series. Susan, so good to see you today.
It's nice to be here. Thanks, Samantha.
Well, Susan, let's kick this off for some of our readers and listeners who might be new to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you first get started writing?
I had a long career in nonprofit work before I started to write fiction. And I worked for colleges and universities, and I headed an Insta Science Institute. So I really, even though I'm not a scientist, but I had a long history of other kinds of work, and I always wrote. Before all of that, I was a reporter, freelance, and then reporting for a daily newspaper, still doing freelance stuff. And then I kind of, I volunteered to work as a publicist for a classical music and dance festival near me. I loved the work. I loved the people. And one of the colleges that had participated in this asked me if I would become their public relations, public affairs, pretty much everything, a small college. And I took the job, and I never looked back. I really love it and loved it. And there was a lot of writing involved. So it's not as though I started writing after I left that career. I was writing all the time. So that's kind of, that was the background before I decided, I got my nerve up and I decided to quit my day job and try to be a fiction writer full time.
Well, that's a very different style of writing though, going from journalism, being a publicist to go to fiction.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. There are times when you're writing, you're doing fundraising or public relations or crisis communications for a university, when maybe a little fiction creeps in the edges, just try to keep things, you know, going. But actually, it is wonderful. I already had a good imagination. I read like crazy, read mysteries and other kinds of fiction. So it wasn't really as though this was a brand clean slate with me. I really had been just so inspired by people like Sue Grafton and a lot of the writers who, women writers of crime fiction, who were just coming into their own in those days. Sarah Paretsky, one of the founders of Sisters in Crime. So I kind of eased into it. I would say became a member of Mystery Writers of America. Went to events every month and, you know, heard how people were building their books and what they were doing. So I think I kind of eased into the water on it.
And what is the inspiration for your different stories? Are you coming up with the fundamental plot line and here's the murder that is the inspiration? Or is it more the characters, the setting? What is it that kind of spurs that initial idea?
Well, the first series I did, which is still in print, the Danny O'Rourke series, is pretty much based factually, or let's say its roots come from the work that I did as a fundraiser and my real serious interest in art. And I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. And she gets to travel to some of the places that I have always loved in the United States, like Santa Fe and Manhattan, New England in the spring. So that it's really setting and character, definitely. And then I think about it, like in that series, I thought a lot about the art world, the secondary art market, which had been flooded with money by the time I started writing seriously in the early 2000s. A lot of it, not so legit. And so I decided to choose three different ways in which art plus money equals crime in the secondary art market. So that kind of was a natural development of my interest. But then, of course, I love France. And I've been to France many times. I have friends in France. And I just decided I wanted to I wanted to write it. I have a lot of friends who are writers and who, you know, people like Cara Black, and other people who write and set their mysteries in France already. So I knew I had to find a place that wasn't Paris, that wasn't glamorous, it wasn't Provence. All of those places are kind of taken by very good writers. But I had friends from here who on this whim sold everything in that they had here and moved to a tiny hamlet in Burgundy. And I went to visit them, and really they're good storytellers themselves. Watch them learning how to integrate themselves into this tiny French village. And that was the inspiration for the French stories, because it's a part of Burgundy that is just absolutely flooded with gorgeous chateaus and wonderful history. But it isn't very much written about, because it's not really a tourist mecca for the most part.
And I think that's one of the other things with these stories that's so enjoyable, in that the setting and the village is so critical in creating that atmosphere, and it's almost its own character in some way, in bringing all these different nuances as Ariel is then adjusting to life in France, and specifically the different village.
I think you're really onto something, and I'm be curious about some of the other people who are listening. I think the setting, the place that a mystery takes place, is really a character and should be. The ones I like the best in other people's writings, the setting is just integral to the story. It adds tension, it adds color, it creates problems, it solves problems. I really think setting, to me, setting and character kind of lead me to the story, to the plot. I start from there. Mm-hmm. And then the plot tends to come after that. So it's like, you know, if you've ever read Deborah Crombie's wonderful long running series set in London, Deb really loves London. And she goes there a couple times a year and embeds herself in a neighborhood and walks and eats the food and listens to the sounds. And to her, and to me, in my own work, that setting is just as much as any other character. I mean, it really is just like where it has to be, where it has to take place.
Yeah, I mean, Deb's a friend of Fresh Fiction. I mean, we've had her here at different events, and I've sat with her at various things. I've known her now for a number of years, and you're right. I couldn't imagine her books in some way set anywhere else, because it is so inherent in the characters and the storyline. And again, I think with yours, it's not even just the location, but it's how it brings all these different characters together. So you do have Ariel from the States, you've got other British friends there, and then the locals from the village, where they're bringing their own dash of spice into that and really making such a cohesive picture.
Yeah. And their eccentricities, which I learned, I met a lot of French people in my friend's village when they moved there. And I was just delighted. I would hear their stories. You know, that this part of France, it's Burgundy, but it's not the side of Burgundy that has all the vineyards. It's the pastoral side. And a lot of those people are multi-generational farmers. They're not well-to-do at all. And they've had their houses and their land passed down from generation to generation for as much as 150 or 200 years. So they're really attached to their place. And they have a certain kind of rootedness and a certain kind of taking things for granted that leads them to be a little eccentric in the way we don't do that. We don't attach, for the most part, quite so much passionate personal familial history to where we live. And some of these folks really do. And it was a delight to meet them. My French is adequate, not great, but my American friends, or she at any rate, has great French. And so I would pick up the nuances later from her in these conversations, and some of those situations wind up in my books.
So do you just keep a journal of those different situations? It's like, okay, this might not work into this story. Oh, it's all, ooh, very nice.
Yeah, I do take photographs, though. I have a cell phone, mm-hmm. and I do take photographs, and the photographs are a wonderful visual reminder of what some of those stories are, and that really helps me a lot, just to remember that it was on this street that I heard this funny comment, or in that cafe that I overheard a conversation. So that the photographs work for me, I guess.
Do you think that also all those different eccentricities and the stories help in the character development also, because they are so unique? And one of the other things that I like with just the overall mystery is the tendency to sometimes ignore some of the laws as they are going yeah. about solving particular mystery at hand. How much of that is where you're pulling in? And is that a natural development, or is it, okay, here's the storyline and here you're adding to certain characters, or do you keep a character library? Okay, is it filed up in the brain with different pictures, or do you actually keep something written out of, oh, here's where I'm keeping these different character traits straight?
You know, because you've talked to a lot of writers, what a pantser is. And I am a pantser. I start writing at the beginning, and somewhere along the line, a character will say something that surprises me, that I didn't know they would say. And that may take me down another path. So I won't say the characters lead me totally astray, but I learn things as I'm writing about the characters and about what's going on. I know at the beginning who did it and what they did and why. But I don't know a lot of what's going on, what's going to happen in the middle. I don't know who's going to be where. I don't know who's going to pick up a clue, who's going to miss a clue. I'm not really sure of that stuff. And in Murder and the Missing Dog, I really didn't know when I started the book how significant the dog was going to be to the story. And I have to say, this is not a crime-solving dog. This dog doesn't talk. This dog doesn't bring back clues. This dog is missing. And when I realized that that was going to happen, because I'd written something about this old woman who actually reminded me of a real old woman that I met and knew in the real town that this is set. She did walk around like a wraith with her dog, with her beautiful, and it is, by the way, a French hunting dog. It's quite beautiful. And I'm not saying what the dog's real name is, because I have got to protect its privacy. But I didn't know at that point when I started writing about this woman, what, if any, role the dog was going to play. And it just kind of happened that, oh, wait a minute, the dog is missing. And that led me to, well, why is the dog missing? Where is the dog? Who's got the dog? So all of that really came about just by following my imagination.
See, and that's what I always find so fascinating, especially talking to mystery writers. And so our readers know, because I bring this up a lot, as a reader myself, I find it just blows my mind sometimes with some reader or mystery writers where they're like, I'm a total pantser. I don't know where it's going to go. So I'm reassured that you have the big points pretty much kind of settled, but then how much you're then developing along the way and discovering it essentially as you go along. There's reassurance in that.
Well, actually, you know,
but also the level of freedom.
Right. Well, actually I have a lot of writer friends, many, many writer friends. And what we tend to say, like Rhys Bowen says this a lot, and Kara Black says it, and Katrina McPherson says it, and you know, all my friends, is that if you're writing and staying in the moment, and you learn something, that means you're excited, more excited, and more engaged in the mystery yourself. I'm not a plotter. I'm not one of those people who writes outlines and stuff, because that would take the excitement for me as the writer, who I want to know, but I want to be surprised. And so that, I think that's what works for my writing, is to say, oh, wait a minute, the dog is missing.
And I think when the authors have that kind of joy when they're going through the process, that comes across to us as the readers.
I hope so.
But as you're going through that, how many different drafts do you sometimes have to go through to get all of those different pieces in place?
It's hard to say, because I hate the notion of starting a draft from scratch. So what I'll do is I will work my way through a manuscript. I will know that there are problems with it. I put little asterisks in if I'm not sure that that's the right thing. Then I go back and call up all the asterisks. And then I do make changes. And I'm lucky. I've had good editors through my whole writing career. At the publishers, I'm traditionally published, and if they may catch something. And they, one of the problems I had with this latest book was I needed to have these women have a lunch together to figure something out. I needed it to happen before something happened at the shop, but then I wanted them to talk about what had happened at the shop, and it was like I was bending time trying to do this. And I realized, you know, I just had to sort of drop that scene and write it from scratch, because it was just not working.
And then also, I mean, there's so many other points in here about the renovation, essentially, of the chateau. It's almost a whole other separate storyline. So how much are you having to go back and plug that in? And is there also levels of research involved of people are like, wait a second, is that really what's going on? Or is that how involved it is? Or... because I think we all have these visions of, you know, from under the Tuscan sun, and it's like, okay, how much is really involved? Because surely this is a piece of cake, right?
Oh.
Anyone who's done renovation knows that's not the case.
I've never done a renovation, and I did know what my friends were doing when they moved to France on their little house. But I also talked, I had some other people I met through them, some Americans, some Belgian people, and another French-American friend I have who was working down in the Camargue on her house. So I did have real people to talk to, but I also did have to do a lot of research. I mean, in the first book especially, there she's had, in order to get water in order to flush toilets, in order to have lights on, there was a lot of really serious work that had to be done. There were, you know, these beautiful slate tiles on the mansard roof was falling off. So I had to do some real research. You know, some of it wasn't so glamorous, like how do we replace the septic system in a house that's, you know, a couple hundred years old. In this case, her chateau is not one of the great, gorgeous, beautiful ones that I love in Burgundy. And that really, and actually some of those chateaus were very helpful for me in visiting them and looking at them and writing. But they were, a lot of those were a lot bigger. Ariel Shepherd has a very small chateau, and it was in very dilapidated shape when her husband left it to her.
Well, I know that it's a journey that I want to continue to see evolving throughout the different books, and as to how she's making the different progress, and it's like, okay, where is she at now? Okay, what's going on? It's a whole other set of storyline there.
Yeah, well, now she can be concentrating more on the inside. You know, the guts are done, and so now she can have the fun of deciding how will I use these rooms? What about this giant place that was for dancing? What about this old hall that has a medieval walk-in fireplace and a balcony above it? What can she do with those? And that's decorating, really. And that's kind of fun. That'd be more fun than, you know, electricity and stuff.
How many books are you expecting to have in this series?
Not sure yet. I'm really not sure. I have several irons in the fire, so we'll kind of have to see where I've got two so far. And the first one was, both of them have been well received critically. And so we'll just see what happens. I'm not quite sure. I'm writing a couple different things at the same time right now. So,
well, okay. So when writing different things, do you find that you have to have different tricks to get into the right mindset for each story? Or are you able to keep them fairly separate anyway?
I am not good. I have, I don't know whether you know Katrina McPherson and you know Reese Bowen. Reese is writing two series that are long running popular series, and she writes a standalone almost every year. I don't know how she does it. She's brilliant. She has a great imagination and she has such a work ethic. It's just unbelievable. And I love her dearly. I would probably, what I'm doing now is I'm taking 2 months to write up a different draft of a different story that's been something I've wanted to do for a long time. So I'm just going to race through a draft on that and take a look at it and see how do I want to pursue this one too. I think it's fun. I think it's going to, this one's got some real humor in it.
Awesome. Well, Susan, let's switch over and get a couple of our fresh fiction facts in. These are meant to be some quick off the top of your head type answers. Sometimes we stump people, but we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Okay, first up, who would you most want to be stuck in an elevator with?
Let me think. Well, Reese is a very close friend, so of course being stuck with Reese would be great. Deb Crombie would be wonderful to be in an elevator with. These are people I know. Katrina McPherson would be making a big joke out of it, and she's hilarious, so that would be lovely. I'm lucky. A lot of these writers are friends of mine. So I like to be stuck in the elevator with a friend.
What is your favorite writing fuel?
Probably sugar. I would drink coffee in the morning. I'll have tea at night. But I must say cookies and ice cream and stuff like that. If I want to give myself a reward for having finished a scene and I'm very happy and excited, then I will go down and get a chocolate chip cookie. Why not?
What luxury item can you not live without?
That's a really good question. What luxury item? I don't have a lot of luxury items in my house. Maybe it's fresh. Well, that isn't a luxury though. I'm trying to think of what's a luxury I can't live without. I'm going to sound really corny when I say this. A luxury to me is a good friend, and I'm lucky to have a handful of really, really good dear friends. And being able to talk with them, see them, or just email back and forth, and know that they're as ready to support me as I am to support them, I think that's probably the big luxury for me.
I love that. And you're right. I mean, being able to appreciate the time with friends, if they're near or far, I think over the last several years, a lot of us come to appreciate that a lot more.
I think
take that time. It's not always there.
I think so. Mm.
Great answer. Okay. What is a clothing or accessory that everyone else hates, but you secretly love?
I don't know who hates what clothing accessories. I love scarves. So maybe if people feel choked up by scarves, I love them. I have a million of them. And I rarely go out without them. The back of my neck gets cold in a hurry and then I feel cold. So that to me is, it doesn't feel tight. It just feels like it makes things more comfortable for me. I don't know that anybody dislikes them though. I don't know what I'm thinking. What do people really dislike? I don't know.
Well, we can go with the scarf because I know some people never want to wear them. I'm like you. I have a whole collection of them that definitely pull out and all different types of designs and colors, and so we can go with that.
Okay.
Okay, other than books, what is something that you own a ridiculous amount of? Since I can tell you've got a few books in the background.
That's even part of them. I have a lot of plants. I am a real gardener. And so I have, at the moment, my garden is just full to bursting of things like roses, and I have a mini meadow that I've planted this year for the first time. So all of those flowers, I have garden tools as well, but that's really a major a hobby, distraction from writing, excuse for not writing is my garden. So I have an unseemly amount of planting.
Love that. We're still at the beginning of the season here. So it's trying to figure out, okay, what plants am I going to focus on this year, with those ones that tend to cycle through. And it's like, okay, let's get them all established. And that way they'll look fantastic in a couple months.
Right. Well, it's, you know, we've had a very cool spring, very cool here in Northern California. And just the other day, it rained so hard, it knocked the barn swallow's nest from under my deck. It was really sad, and we had hail. So, but now it's like 80 degrees outside, and everything is just blooming and perfectly happy.
Yep, I had to go out and water before book club. It's in that
I
in between
watered too.
Stage.
I did too.
Do I have to wait for water?
I did.
My priorities. Got to go do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, what is your most dog-eared copy of a book? The one that you just constantly go back to?
I'm trying to think. I guess if I go back in time historically, Sue Grafton's, I don't know if it'll be any one in particular, but some of Sue Grafton's middle of the alphabet books when she'd really hit her stride. I'm not sure which, I don't know which letter to give you, but I like her books a lot. They hold up for me in rereading. So that's, you know, that really is. And a funny thing, I write mysteries, and I think Daphne du Maurier kind of was great at writing suspense, domestic suspense. And so I'll look at that book sometimes and say, how did she do that? How did she make me so nervous reading this scene? I'd like to, you know, I'd like to capture some of that way that she could build tension. So I do go back and look at her books.
All right, you've been kidnapped, but 2 hours later, you're returned because you cannot stop talking about what?
My cats. I have two cats. I'm an old cat lady. I have to say, that's the way it's. I love, by the way, I love dogs too, but cats are so much easier. So I have two cats, one of whom is elderly and not in great shape anymore. And the other one I adopted, who is a tripod. She only has three legs, and she's absolutely adorable. She does not know that she is in any way other abled, let's say. So I have post cat pictures, and I would probably, if I were kidnapped, I would bore my kidnappers to death by showing them pictures of my darling, darling cats, who are both orange female tabbies.
Love that. And definitely cats, so kind of high maintenance in a way, just from an attitude standpoint sometimes, but definitely easier some days than dogs.
Well, on a cold, wet, rainy night in December, it's nicer to have cats who can use the litter box inside than it would be to put on all that paraphernalia and take a dog for a walk. I really do love dogs. I was listening to your section before, and I really love golden retrievers. I don't care that they're not smart. They're so sweet. I love them to death. I had a friend who had two gorgeous, regal French poodles, standards, and I love them too. And another writer, I don't know, James L'Etoile, I don't know if you know him, he and his wife have corgis, and they are so adorable. I can't believe it. So I love them all, but maybe I'm lazy. I don't know.
There's nothing like the cat just curled up with you and purring in your ear. The dogs right. don't do that. So
no, they lick can't you. Trade they that. Lick your face, and I don't like that.
Would you rather go back in time to meet your ancestors or travel into the future and meet your descendants?
You asked that question of Lisa, because I was listening to that one too. You know, I would like to go back. I think there I have bits and pieces of family history, but not a great deal. And all the people who could share family history with me are gone. And I would love to know more about my Irish ancestors who came here. And I have German ancestors too. And I think they probably all came over in the mid 19th century. And some of them did very well, and some of them probably didn't. But I'd like to know more about them.
Okay, if it was real, would you rather meet a ghost or an alien?
Could I just slam my door, both of them? No. I would probably, I don't think an alien, I don't know enough about alien. I think it would probably have to be a ghost. I almost thought that I saw the ghost of my mother once, about 6 weeks after she died. I woke up, my husband was sleeping next to me. I woke up and there was a white mist in the other corner of the bedroom. And I thought, I didn't hear my mother speak, and didn't look like my mother, but I had an understanding that she was saying that everything was okay. I have no idea where that came from, but it didn't. It scared me at the time, but I thought, oh, maybe, you know. So I think maybe I'd go with the ghost.
Okay, I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot, I feel, with this next question, because you are friends with so many different writers and read their works also. But is there a particular writer, and we can even qualify other than your friends, okay? But is there an author who you just have to read all of their work? Anything new that comes out, go out, make sure you read all of their backlist. Who is that must-read author for you?
Well, there's probably one or two, but one is Mick Herron. His Slough House mysteries are absolutely fantastic. And even though I don't usually like television that's made out of books, I think, in fact, this series that was made from his book, The Slough House Mysteries, is fantastic. It's exactly like the books, and I love the books. I have the whole set. And I will only let myself read one every month or so. So I still have two left to go because I love them so much. And I know he's finished with them, finished writing them. So that's one. And I would just also, you know, Jackie Winspear is just publishing the last of the Maisie Dobbs books. And I really enjoyed those books so, so much. And she is a lovely person. I know her. We both. I know her. I know her pretty well. I may see her very soon, as a matter of fact. But I do. I can't wait to read that book. I just can't wait.
And I love that you're only letting yourself read them sometimes once a month or wait so that you can savor it. I've got series like that too, where I'm like, I don't need to finish it immediately. It can take me a while. And some of the readers can attest on how long it's taking me to go through some series because I'm listening to them on audio. But that's okay, because I know it's like my comfort. I know that I have that next one ready, and I'm not looking at that instant end anytime soon.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, Susan, what is the best way for our readers and listeners to keep up with you and find out about what's coming next?
Well, I have two Facebook pages, but one is author, Susan C. Shea author. And I do post things there. I'm doing a couple of events. Gee, tomorrow I'm driving up to Davis, California to do a live event with Claire Booth. I don't know if she's ever been on your show, but she writes a mystery series that's terrific, about a cop. And then on Saturday, I'm doing another live event at Book Passage in Corte Madera here in Marin County with Terry Shames. who has a long running series about a Texas cop and has just jumped off the deep end of the diving board with a brand new series. So I, you can see things about those events and other events on my Facebook page for writers, which is Susan Z. Shea, author. I also have an Instagram page that I need to do better at when I figure out how to do it better. And I have my own website, SusanCShea.com. And I'd love to have more people sign up for my newsletter, which they can do on the contact page of that. And I'm going to be doing some, I'm going to be doing a couple newsletters about chateaus in France, I think, pretty soon.
Awesome. Well, Susan, thanks for joining us this evening. And everyone should definitely go check out the latest book in the Chateau in Burgundy series.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Great. Now stick around for some additional questions and happy hour with our readers.
I will. Thank you very much for a great interview.